This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Terry Phoenix knows what it's like to be an outsider. As a young child in a poor family, Terry moved more than 10 times before starting high school and was always the new kid. And then Terry's isolation got worse. Terry came out in a small South Georgia town with no visible LGBTQ community and ended up running away from home. But Terry's survival tool was to try to find at least one person to connect with who accepted Terry, and Terry for who Terry was. Now Terry is the director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill and works to create a safe and inclusive environment for others. Terry goes by T. T, welcome. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about your life growing up. You moved around a lot. Why was that?
Yeah, my mom moved us around a lot. She had five different husbands and a couple of boyfriends in between husbands. And so it seemed like with each new man that came in the household, we relocated. One of those husbands was also in the military. And so as a military brat, you move around. So it was a pretty chaotic growing up.
What was your relationship with your mom?
It was tense. She wasn't really there a lot. It was funny because in some ways she did a really great thing. She coached a little league baseball team for me when I was in third grade because the other coaches wouldn't let me, because I was a girl, play on their teams. And so she decided that she would coach a team so that I could play. So that's an example of a shining moment with my mom. But there were a lot of not so shining moments. And so our relationship was pretty rough. And it kind of came to a head when I was in high school and came out.
Were you close to anyone in your family?
My grandfather.
Yeah,
my nan-daddy. He was my mom's dad, and he and I were two peas in the pod from the very beginning. And he really, growing up, he's the sort of the stabilizing force in my young years. And he also encouraged me to get an education. You know, no matter where we were, no matter what was happening, he would always say, do well in school, get your education, because that's something that once you have it, nobody can take it from you. And summers with him were just fantastic. He had a boat on the Ohio River. And so we would go up in the summers and visit with him and spend all day skiing and cook out on the grill.
And where was he?
He was in Jeffersonville, Indiana.
And was that a stable? I mean, is that the one place you went back to every summer?
So yeah. Yeah, 213 Chippewa Drive. That was his house, he and my grandmother, Gigi and Nandetti's house. And so that was the one place that we kind of could call a home base.
10 addresses through high school, but Chippewa, you remember.
Right? I remember that one.
Of course.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you talked about coming out and how difficult that was between you and your mom. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I came out, I guess it was in early 80s. I forget exactly how old. But I was early teens, and I had been dating this guy and realized that I really was attracted to a woman, a particular woman. And my mom had these friends who were gay, a gay couple. And so that was kind of how I learned about gay and lesbian people. And I realized that that was what was true for me. And so I broke up with the boyfriend and, I didn't really make a big announcement, but I just sort of started living my life and being interested in girls. And That was really a tense place for me and my mom. There was a lot of stuff going on at home at the time, too, between she and her then husband. And I think that they blamed my friend Jody and her family for me becoming gay, you know.
Yeah, who is Jody?
Jody is, she was my high school coach, and she's the oldest daughter of my high school coach. And so she and I have been friends for over 30 years now. She lives here in Durham, and we get together every Sunday morning at Elmo's and have breakfast. So, Jody's quite the fixture.
Well, it's interesting because you said your mom had friends who were gay openly. She apparently had an open enough mind about that.
Yeah, but not when it came to me.
Yeah,
when it came to me, she was very concerned that I had been under the bad influence and of someone, and she felt like she needed to protect me, and she took me to a therapist, and they tried to talk me out of being gay, and, you know, kind of the stereotype that you hear. Sometimes the stereotypes are true, right?
Right. Well, what was going on in were you arguing with her? Were you curious? Did you think, well, maybe there, at some point, did you sort of drink the tea and think, hey, maybe there is something wrong with me? What was going on with you?
Well, the only book that I could find when I was in high school was Homosexuality and Mental Illness. So, you know, I certainly was getting a lot of messages that there was something wrong with me. But, you know, identity is a funny thing. You know, there's something inside that tells you who you are, and other voices can confirm or deny that, but it still doesn't really change who you are at the core. And once I kind of realized that I was a lesbian, you know, it just, that was what was true. And even though I didn't get any support around that, I didn't have a lot of confirmation, and there was no community in Pembroke, Georgia, I still knew that that was true. And so I think a large part of my wanting to get out of Pembroke, Georgia and go somewhere else was maybe I could find more people like me elsewhere.
So you ran away?
Well, I ran away. I didn't run far. I ended up in foster care in Pembroke. So it was, you know, I was able to stay in high school, and I was able to maintain ties with Coach Height and his wife, Mariana, and Jody. And that their family really took me in. You know, I mean, he kept me in school and she kept me alive. And
well, tell me more about that relationship and how that went. They understood what was happening with you. You were open with them.
Yeah. Jody and I were best friends and have been friends for a very long time. And her dad was just a big, big heart. And, you know, I think that he knew that there were some things that were problematic in my house. And so he took me under his wing, and I was a runner and he was a runner. And so he'd take me to cross country and road races and that kind of thing. And I would end up staying over the weekend. And their family really just adopted me and gave me a lot of love and nurturance. They didn't adopt me in the legal sense because my mom would not have that.
Well, and in fact, your mom wouldn't even go for this extra legal relationship, right? I mean, she eventually got a court order.
Right. She got a court order, no contact order, restraining order.
And yeah. So what did you, is that when you went into foster care?
And I did go into foster care, yeah, my junior year. Yeah.
What was that? That was also difficult for you because it turns out your foster mom was had some of the same ideas that your mother did.
Yeah. They, you know, gender is a funny thing. When you start messing with gender, people get really upset about that. And Ms. Polk really had a hard time with me because of my gender expression. You know, I wore guys' clothes. You know, I don't know if she knew about me being a lesbian. I never had that conversation with her, but it's, you know, it wasn't a secret from anybody. So she would have me get up with her in the mornings at like 5:30 or whatever, and she had some prayer show that she watched and would make me pray with her in the mornings. And, you know, that was not really what I wanted to be doing as a high schooler.
You had the sense that she was trying to pray the gay away, was
yeah,
she?
Yeah, definitely.
That had to be not easy. You're listening to The State of Things on WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Frank Stacio, and my guest is Terry Phoenix, who is currently the director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. You were getting into trouble a lot in foster care, right?
I was getting into trouble. I had quite the temper. I got in trouble at school and in the foster care setting. I had grown up without a lot of adult supervision, and so the idea that someone would tell me that there's a curfew and that I had to be a certain place at a certain time, I really didn't do very well with that. And I was just really angry. I had a lot of anger, and I think that was really coming to the forefront when I was in high school.
You got in trouble with the cops also. Was that for running away from home or for some of the other
activities? It was for running away from home and stealing the weapon that I stole when I left. And
which was what?
It was a .45.
So what was the plan? What was your plan?
I don't know that I had one, Frank. I just knew that I needed to get out of where I was, honestly. I was 16 years old, and I just knew that I needed to get out of where I was. I think if I'd have had my druthers, I would have gone to live with Jody and her parents. That's what I would have liked.
That's interesting because that's off the table legally. You can't even do that, right?
Right.
Because of the court order.
Right.
Foster care turns out not to be a place. You have your grandfather encouraging an education.
Right.
But at the moment, by the time you're 16, 17, did you think an education was possible for you?
I did not. I think I was as surprised as anyone when the scholarship offer came through for East Carolina University. That's where I went to school.
How did that come about?
I don't remember exactly how it came about. I just know that Coach talked to me about it one day and said, if you want to go to college, you know, it's possible. You have an out-of-state tuition waiver, you know, scholarship to play softball and to run cross country at East Carolina University. I didn't have another plan, so I said yes. You know, I figured it would accomplish a couple of things. I would get out of Pembroke And it would give me something to do next when I had no clue really what I was supposed to do next.
We should point out now, now you're talking about Pembroke, Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
And get to ECU. And you got there, what was that like?
Well, I thought that I could run away from all of my emotions and all of my past. And funny thing about running away, no matter where you go, there you are. And so, you know, it was better in that there was a community. You know, there were other gay and lesbian people there that I met and had community and made friends, and that was wonderful. East Carolina University, Pitt County, wasn't the progressive mecca, shall we say. And so there was still some of that isolation and still some of that discrimination that happened. And you had to be mindful and you had to be careful and thoughtful. But I loved playing ball. I loved running. You know, I loved school.
We'll talk more about what you were mindful of, how you worked your way through it, and how you got where you are today. Terry Phoenix, my guest, director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. More after the break on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Terry Phoenix. She goes by T. She's director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. A lot of letters there. An awful lot of letters. Tell us about that. You said you were assigned a gender at birth, like mm-hmm. all of us. That was female. You then began to know that you were a lesbian and now identify as transgender.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a journey. And my journey around gender identity kind of started, I started questioning that in the early 2000s. I had gone to a conference called Southern Comfort. And I met other trans-identified people there. And in listening to them talk about their lives and their relationship to their body, I realized that I recognized myself. And so started spending some more time talking to people and slowly kind of indeed recognized myself that I was transgender, that I had a different relationship to my body and that my lifelong lack of fit with the idea of woman or female made some sense to me.
And help us sort that out. The idea of identifying as a woman who is a lesbian is different than identifying as transgender, period.
Language is a funny thing. You know, it's fluid and it's contested. And some people would say you can't be a lesbian unless you identify as a female. And I don't really get tangled up into that. What I know to be true for me is that I was assigned female at birth. And I was born, you know, with particular features on my body, and I didn't relate well to all of those features, and I didn't feel like female got all of me. You know, it gets a part of me, but it doesn't get all of me, whereas there are a lot of ways that sort of a more masculine identity really fit for me, both in terms of my body, in terms of how society defines what's masculine and feminine. Those kinds of
things. It does speak to the bereavement, I guess, of our culture because so much of this is culturally constructed, right?
Absolutely.
What we identify with, how we identify, how we dress. We noticed it in the language. We really wanted to honor your desire to be identified as T mm-hmm. and to not have a pronoun she associated. And it get hard to write. And so the two of us, Anita was writing the intro, I'm writing the billboard, and we're trying to, and it was awkward. Yeah. And we're trying to get past the awkwardness. And at some point I said, you know what? That's the point. It has become so comfortable for us to create this binary and mm-hmm. live in it mm-hmm. that all of the built environment and all of our language reinforces this overly simplified, what otherwise would be beautifully complex.
Right, right.
A spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah, it creates, there is no space to stand if you don't identify as male or female. Mm. It's a very challenging thing. And the reality is that even at the physiological level, we know that there's variety. I mean, folks are born intersex, much, much more common than muscular dystrophy. But we don't know about intersex people. We don't know about varieties of bodies because we put them in these two boxes and say that they have to stay there. And if you step outside of those boxes, too far, then you get reprimanded in right. some way, shape, or form.
I mean, that's the painful and the shocking thing. Mm-hmm. Not so much that for convenience, perhaps we've created this binary, although it is, as I say, it's a form of bankruptcy, a cultural bankruptcy. But the idea that once you buy that, once you accept the binary, anybody who steps outside of that is mm-hmm. utterly on the outside. There's no way that we can take you in. In fact, we have to criticize you. It's not just that we don't accept
right.
it.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly.
You felt that, you said at ECU, a little bit better than perhaps Pembroke, Georgia. There was some way, how so? Was there some community there that was?
There was community there. There were a number of other people on the softball team that identified as lesbian, and so there was a community of folks there that I could relate to and you know, just sort of be Terry. And that's really what it's about. It's not that I need someone to, you know, affirm every single second that my being gay or being transgender. It's just I want to live my life without those things being problematic or being in the way and be able to speak openly and freely. And I could do that more at ECU than I could at Pembroke.
Were you beginning to imagine a future at that point?
I think more so than before, because I remember I was majoring in psychology and I did think about that I wanted to work with youth. I wanted to grow up and work with youth, and particularly youth that had been dealt a raw hand and gay and lesbian youth, because I knew what it was like. I knew how much it meant to me that Coach and Mariana were there for me to have people that affirmed me. And so I wanted to kind of do that for someone else.
You talked about your grandfather early on for you, Coach and his family. What about when you got to ECU? Were you able to find a particular individual there you could identify with, connect with?
Not so much at ECU. You know, there was a therapist that I worked with named Sue that was really helpful in starting to set me on a path to peace with my past. But yeah, Jody was a key support for me through college.
What was happening now to your relationship with your grandfather, your mother, the coach, now once you got to college?
Well, once I left and was in the foster home, I didn't have any more relationship really to my mom. I had some interactions because I have a younger sister, and so I was trying to maintain some contact with my younger sister. And so that necessitated some every now and then contact with my mom, but I really didn't want anything to do with her. My grandfather, on the other hand, we remained close and, in fact, got closer as I got to be an adult and had more autonomy and ability to see him and be in touch with him. So my grandfather and I were close all the way to the end. In fact, I was his guardian the last three years of his life.
You decided to attend the March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights in 1987.
Yeah.
That was an important event for you.
Yeah, it was a huge event. And, you know, it was one of the largest gatherings at the time that it happened for gay and lesbian people. And so I was one of those people that was there. And I honestly was blown away by how many of us there were. Because even though there were more folks in Greenville than Pembroke, we still weren't a mass of folks. You know, we were still a minority and still rather invisible. And so to be amidst these, you know, hundreds of people, thousands of people, however many were there that year, and be able to walk proudly and feel some pride in my identity. That was an amazing experience.
Did it change anything for you in terms of, again, your vision for yourself in the future?
Well, I think it made me more willing to talk about my life and to be open about it, because I did actually go back and I started talking in classes and trying to start a student organization for gay and lesbian students. And we were never able to start the organization, but because I couldn't find enough people to be willing to put their name on the line as members. But I think that really did start me on this track of trying to educate people about gay and lesbian people.
And that would have been the time, of course, the HIV epidemic was getting headlines.
Yeah.
Was that any part of your consciousness at the time?
It was. I had a friend who died in 87, 88, I think it was. And nobody really knew what he died of. You know, I mean, there was still so much we did not know. And so as a part of my reaction to that grief, I ended up getting involved in a very distant way with ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And so, you know, took some role in Atlanta, actions in Atlanta and D.C. And, you know, again, that was another powerful step forward of owning my identity and not letting myself be defined in other people's vision.
You talked about, too, at one point, an editorial or letter to the editor that your grandfather wrote that was pretty important.
Yeah, my grandfather sent me a letter, and he had this letter that he had sent to the Louisville paper, and it was in support of equal benefits because they were talking about getting benefits equity, you know, for same-sex partners. And that really meant a lot to me because, you know, he was born in 1911. And for my grandfather to have been born in 1911 and to be that supportive of me and accepting and affirming really just meant the world.
I mean, it means that he has to step out, too. It's one thing to have a personal relationship with you and to mm-hmm. be supportive, but for him to mm-hmm. say publicly, perhaps in a milieu where among friends who wouldn't accept that.
Right, right. But my grandfather, you know, one of the things he modeled was you always are who you are, and you just be who you are and you be true to yourself. And I really think that he modeled that. He didn't teach me that so much by telling it to me, but just by watching him. He was who he was always, and I think I picked up on that.
And for a lot of your life, you felt, as you said, or perhaps as we said, and you agreed with the outsider, but at some point you realized that you weren't as outside as you might have been. You started dating an African-American woman who changed some of your thinking.
Oh, yeah. Too. She really helped me learn about white privilege. You know, I had no idea about white privilege, no idea that about racism and how it functions. And you know, the first time that she told me, you know, well, you have some privilege that I don't, you know, as an African-American woman, you as a white person have privilege. And I didn't understand that. And I argued with her. And it took me a long time. And I'm grateful that there were a number of people that were very patient with me until I started seeing and looking around. Yeah, you know, flesh-tone Band-Aids are flesh-tone for white people. You know, that's a very simple example, but there are a lot of those kinds of examples.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of how it's embedded in the language. Mm-hmm. It's this ground you walk mm-hmm. on and you don't understand mm-hmm. the foundations. It is surprising, I mean, to think that you had been through so much and felt so isolated mm-hmm. to then come to this next level of discrimination, I
right.
guess.
Well, and I think about if I had been an African-American or Latina person, you know, would I have been given probation instead of being sent to juvenile detention center? You know, there's always those questions about how much did my white skin provide me some protection and opportunity for second chances.
Right. And then those second chances lead you. Exactly. And otherwise you'd be on a whole different path. Maybe not here talking with me today. You did graduate. You planned to be a psychologist, right?
I did, yeah. I was going to be a psychologist, and I was going to use recreation and leisure as a form of treatment. I had no idea there was a whole field called therapeutic recreation that was already doing that. I went to Wright School Reeducation Center and taught there for 2 years and used recreation and leisure as treatment modalities. And then I went to Greensboro. And worked at a psychiatric hospital, and that was where I found out about therapeutic recreation, and so went back to get my master's degree because you had to have a certain certification to do the work I wanted to do.
Is what? What kind of populations were you going to work with?
Well, you have to, in the state of North Carolina, there's a title act, so to call yourself a therapeutic recreation specialist, you have to have certain qualifications and titles and degrees. And so I didn't have that. And so in order to do the work that I wanted to, I had to go back to school.
But therapy and treatment for what?
Mostly youth with emotional behavioral disorders. And then I also wanted to work with gay and lesbian youth. So at the same time that I was sort of having my career path, I was also working in nonprofit. This helped start a nonprofit called Gay and Lesbian Adolescent Support Services, or GLASS, in Greensboro. And so I couldn't figure out how to meld those two loves, you know, and so I kind of had my career and then I had my volunteer time.
Tell us about GLASS. That was certainly something you didn't have growing up, right?
Right. And again, having the experience of not having that support really made me believe that having that support would be a change maker, would be a difference maker for youth. And so there was a group of women and a couple men, and we rented this house that was in downtown Greensboro and sort of made it the place that we had different events and people could come for hangouts and group chats and, you know, peer support and discussion, those kinds of things. And just trying to make a space where youth could see that you can grow up as a gay or lesbian person and have a life and do well.
Was it the kind of thing? I mean, it's interesting because things had changed, too. Our conversation had changed. There may have been, and you can maybe not, but it seems things may have been a little more open and a little more comfortable for gay and lesbian communities for the group you were working with or at that time than it was for you growing up. I mean, is that true? And was
No, because we're still in the early 90s. And I think the HIV/AIDS epidemic, you know, really, because there was quite a stigma that if you were gay or lesbian, you must have AIDS. You know, there was still such a stigma about that. And so I think that, you know, made it hard still.
What did you learn by bringing those groups together or starting that group from young people who are sort of in your situation but didn't have the advantage of that support group? What did you learn about – did it make you think differently about your own history?
I don't know that it made me think differently about my own history other than it helped me to see there was some benefit in my history, you know, that it wasn't meaningless. The fact that I had experienced all the things that I had experienced growing up and as a teenager helped me connect with youth in a way that I don't know that I would have been able to otherwise. And so in that way, you know, I see how my experience would benefit others, I guess I would say.
You also worked in detention centers and psychiatric hospitals, but detention centers as well. What was that experience like?
That was interesting to go in someplace and have the doors locked behind you. Definitely a different experience. I decided very quickly that I did not want to work in a prison system or a detention center. I was doing an internship, and that's when I worked at the detention center. I loved it. I loved working with the kids, and I think I saw, you know, that could have been me, right? You know, that could have been my story as well, but for some interventions and some luck. And choices that I made.
Is the work there, again, we're talking, I mean, I think at the heart of this discussion is social constructions of various identities, right? And mm-hmm. and sort of how, in many cases, you have to fight through that if they didn't, you know, if you didn't get a name, if your category isn't named, it's one of the acceptable ones. Detention, once you're in the criminal justice system,
right.
It seems to me that that's another layer of impossible identity that's very difficult to climb out of or escape
yeah.
from.
Definitely. Yeah. Once you have that behind your name or once you have that experience, it is hard to get away from it.
Your career path then changed a little bit.
Yeah. I fell in love with teaching when I went to a master's program at Greensboro. And so I ended up going to University of Georgia to get a PhD. And I had in mind then that I would become a teacher at a university. I would become a faculty member at a university, and that I would still do some community-based practice. Still trying to figure out how I could merge my love of doing LGBTQ work with my love of teaching and research and those kinds of things.
What kind of things did you think you might teach?
Recreation and leisure studies.
I was going to stay with that.
And identity development.
Right.
I really, you know, those two things were really the cornerstone of what I did with my PhD work. Because I think it's fascinating. I think recreation and leisure is a space of maximal freedom. You know, not complete freedom. But it's a space more than any other place where we get a little more room to be ourselves. And recreation had been so important in my life that I just had such a passion for trying to create those spaces.
You're listening to The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Terry Phoenix, director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. It seems to me that, you know, it's ideal in many ways because you're working with the body and bodily expression. And so some way of saying that I am the embodiment of who I am, whatever you called me, would be a pretty good way to get at an essential identity mm-hmm. Over and against what it was they're calling you on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find, was it working that way? Was it the sense of embodiment and being able to express yourself physically that was important to you?
Well, I loved being able to express myself physically. I loved athletics. I loved using my body. I think that it wasn't until I came out as transgender and started making peace with my body and made some decisions about top surgery, you know, so that I could be more comfortable in my body. You know, people transition in a lot of different ways. Some people take hormones, some people don't, some people have surgery, some people don't. Some people change their gender marker, some people don't. In my case, I decided to have my breasts removed, have a double mastectomy. And that came about because I was talking to a student one day in the center, and I was, you know, they were debating whether or not they were going to have this procedure. And I looked at them and I said, you know, you get to have a body in which you feel comfortable. And those words just kind of hung in the air. And that was really what tipped me to go, oh, maybe I need to take my own advice there. So I really got much more comfortable in my body after that.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, that in that because of the social order and because of the constructions that we've imposed, in order to be comfortable, you're the one who has to change, that we haven't created space for you to look like the person, the body you were born in, and accept that you're going to be who you are.
Well, I think that people would have been fine had I kept the body that I was in, but I wouldn't have been fine.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have felt comfortable.
On the State of Things today, Terry Phoenix, director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. More of our conversation on the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Terry Phoenix, the director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. So before the break, we were talking about feeling comfortable in your own body. You talked about having your breast removed, that they made you uncomfortable. And my question suggested that maybe that's because, we just expect that if you have breasts, you're going to be female. And the discomfort may have been a cultural expectation that you wanted to escape. But you say, no, that's not it.
No, it's the breasts themselves did not fit for me. And, when every other girl in sixth grade was stuffing their training bras and hoping their breasts would grow, I was hoping that mine never came in. And so, throughout my life, would wear really super tight sports bras or wrap them with ACE bandages. And so it wasn't so much other people's definition of my body as it was my own sense of my body didn't fit me. And again, there's a lot of ways that people transition, but this was my story.
I mean, that's interesting because it really gets at this question of knowing who you are, and you know that, and then trying to fit into this binary and sort of having people not believe that you can actually be the authority on who you are.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And what would be possible if we trusted that people are the authority on who they are and we made space for that? I mean, that would be a miraculous and wonderful world, I think.
Yeah. Well, and what would we lose if we offered that spectrum and allowed everybody to live on that instead of in the binary? You then, you taught, you said you wanted to be a psychologist. You went to, we talked about getting your PhD. What happened after that?
I came back to North Carolina. A friend of mine had started an organization called Safe Schools North Carolina, which was to try to work to make the schools in North Carolina safer for LGBTQ youth. And so I came back and served on the board and was a trainer in that organization, doing teaching and trainings with all kinds of different organizations. A lot of them were schools because that was our focus. And I was doing my dissertation research, which was looking at identity and recreation and leisure spaces and how those discourses around sexuality and shape space and what that allows or doesn't allow for people in recreation and leisure.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. That's interesting because we had a small conversation about the impact of language and the way it can reinforce these constructions. How about the built environment, particularly when it comes to recreation?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people don't recognize how much they read the environment when they walk into a space. You know, what's on the walls? What music is playing? Who's in the space and what do they look like? Are there variations of gender presented in the space or is it very much in a gender binary? Are there same-sex couples that are visible? Does the organization itself support NC Pride or any kind of thing that says that LGBT people are welcome? But really, if you are a marginalized person, if you have an identity that's marginalized, you're reading that the whole time because you're trying to figure out how much of myself can I bring into this space? How real can I be? How visible can I be? And what I found in my research is that, people paid attention to those things in their environment, and to the extent that there were more indicators that were supportive of LGBTQ communities, they felt like that they could be more visible and more themselves in those spaces. And to the extent that there wasn't, they felt like they had to hide or cover who they were.
And that's interesting because you talk about the marginalized community sort of making conscious decisions or conscious observations. The rest of us are still reading the environment and we're seeing all of that. But because there's no real threat to us, we're simply being reinforced.
Exactly.
In the sense that this is how it always was, or at least over the last 10,000 years. So what does that mean for the average playing field? I mean, does this translate? Are you talking about spaces within schools, gymnasium, or, can a playing field somehow?
Yeah, all spaces. I mean, all of our spaces are very heteronormative. There's very much an expectation that people are only male or female, and that if you are female, that you are going to behave in certain ways, and that, of course, you're going to be attracted to males. and not other females. And from very early in schools, we get those messages and those things get reinforced. You know, if two little first graders who are of the same gender are holding hands and talk about, you know, we're going to get married, they get a different reaction than if a girl and a boy are walking around as first graders holding hands and saying, we're going to get married. You know, the latter is cute and the former is problematic.
You ended up and where you are now, you may not end up there, but you're there now. Let's put it that way, at the LGBTQ Center at UNC. How did you get there?
Well, I like to say I fell into the job because I was paying bills by doing construction work and painting. And I had an extension ladder collapsed on me. And so I literally fell, you know, 20 feet and was injured pretty severely such that I couldn't do that kind of work to pay the bill. So I started asking around, you know, my friends to see, you know, have you heard of any job openings? And a friend of mine who works at UNC knew about the opening at the LGBTQ Center. They were looking for a graduate assistant at the time. And so I was a graduate student, so I applied and I got the position. And that's actually how I started, was as a graduate student. And then in that first year, they were hiring for an assistant director and a director. And I put my name in the hat for the assistant director and got that job. And then the next year, the person they had hired as director didn't come, ended up not coming. And so I was sort of running things day to day. And when they opened the position search for a director, I put my name in the hat and I got that job. So I've held all of the positions just about that there are at the center.
You fell into the job and then climbed the ladder.
Yes, exactly.
As it were. Yeah, you can add that now to the resume. What was the center doing at the time and what were you doing?
Well, Center was doing safe zone trainings, which is a 4-hour training that people can learn about heterosexism. They can learn about what the experiences are of LGBT students, staff, and faculty, and they can learn how they can be more supportive and more inclusive. And they get a plaque after they've gone through that. And so the reason that's important is going back to earlier when we talked about reading the environment. When people see those plaques, they can take a little bit bigger, deeper breath and go, oh, okay, I don't have to hide so much here. So Safe Zone had already been started. We were doing some programming for undergraduates a lot, but there wasn't really much happening for graduate students, and there wasn't a lot happening in terms of advocacy beyond the center, outside with the rest of the university. And so that was really where I turned my attention, was we needed to find ways to impact some of those larger policies that impacted individuals, even though they never saw the policies. And so I spent some time trying to get people to learn about the center, learn about what we did. I got put on some committees, and then that opened the door to be able to influence some of the policies.
And what were those policies?
Well, for example, the non-discrimination statement did not include gender identity and gender expression when I got there. And I felt it was really important for us to include that. So that people who had variant gender expressions or gender identities that weren't cisgender could see that the university supported and affirmed them.
You know, there are a lot of people who think that the university is the, you know, sort of the most liberal place on earth. Why would anybody need to do work on those campuses? But you do.
It is and it isn't. Mm-hmm. I think it is still an institution, and institutions have been for so long shaped by this set of principles, you know, this gender binary and heteronormativity. And so, you know, students are walking into a space expecting it to be very open and progressive, but they're encountering the same discourses in those spaces that exist elsewhere. The difference is there's just more support within college, university.
Tell us about some of those crises. You had an interesting story about a student who had a doctoral dissertation scheduled and had a crisis.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of how heterosexism functions, and a lot of times people don't see it unless they're impacted by it. There was a student who had a same-sex partner, and their partner became very ill about a week and a half, 2 weeks before they were scheduled to have their oral comprehensive exams. And that's a really big deal at a university setting, going for your oral comps. And the student was not comfortable, was not sure if they could talk to their faculty members about their partner being so seriously ill. Because what they were weighing was, do I come out and risk there being some negative repercussions, or do I sort of give short shrift to both my preparation for comps and my partner and not say anything?
If you had a heterosexual relationship, you'd you wouldn't think twice about it.
Right,
you'd
exactly.
You'd ask for grace and exactly. probably get it. So what was the resolution?
The person decided to talk to their faculty, and the faculty just let them postpone their date.
How do you think it
ended up being a good story.
Being a good story. How do you think having a center in some place where you can go talk about that made a difference in that person's life?
I hope that it enabled the person to feel more confident moving forward with asking that faculty member, knowing that they had someone to talk through that and think it through with, but also that there was someone else at the institution who knew what was going on. You know, if it had gone badly, I would have been there to support that student and to help them find, you know, some steps that they could have taken.
You also spend time helping faculty understand how to be more sensitive to LGBTQ students. Can you give us an example of how that might work?
Yeah, I think the classroom is another space that gets constructed. And unfortunately, it still gets constructed along very specific lines. And so LGBT students that are in those spaces often feel marginalized or on the outside unless a faculty member does things like intentionally including the non-discrimination statement in their syllabus. If they have a requirement that there are some LGBT-themed readings, or at least it comes up in conversation if there aren't, how are classroom discussions handled? You know, what gets said and what gets challenged?
And certifications on the wall, all that sort of thing, if you've been certified mm-hmm. in this training. I mean, it can be mind-boggling in a way. And crushing is a burden. If you think about just some of the things we've been talking about, all of the unseen ways in which we reinforce
yeah.
these constructions, you might think, well, how can we ever kind of see our way through this? But I'm going to get mighty lofty here for just a moment. It does suggest that all of these constructions are in service to something even larger than that. I mean, we've got a social and economic order that sort mm-hmm. of that seems to thrive on this kind of thing. I mean, do we have to ask the very big questions, or can we be working on this case by case by case?
I think that I'm sort of pitching at the middle, you know. I'm attentive to the impacts on the individual and really trying to support the individual. And again, that goes back to my own experiences, you know, growing up and feeling very isolated and knowing how important it is to have one person, just one, that supports you and values you and can help you. My life would be very different without Coach and Mariana and Nandetti and Meg Kemper. My life would look tremendously different. So I want to be that for other people. But I also want to change the systems where I can. And I am working at the institutional level, and I like working at that level because all of the people that we impact are going to go out and be doctors and lawyers and teachers, and they're going to then impact the institutions and in which they work.
Yeah, because it can work back the other way. If the institutions change and it changes our mind, those big pictures can start to change too. They don't
right.
have to remain static. Your work at the center also introduced you to your wife.
Yes.
Tell us about
yes,
that.
Yes, indeed. So Kendra, my wife, she was a psychologist at UNC Chapel Hill. And so we actually met each other by working together. She did an outreach program at the LGBTQ Center. And she was also a Safe Zone trainer. And so we just really kind of clicked and became friends. And I tell the story that, you know, we were friends and everything was great and wonderful. And then one day she walked in and I said, Hey, Kendra, you know, and something shifted. And so we ended up starting to date each other, and we dated for a year, very traditional. We dated for a year and then got engaged to get married and got married and then a year later had a child. So, you know, very traditional of us.
You're listening to The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Talking to Terry Phoenix, who is director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. You talked about your daughter. You're raising her. What are some of the challenges in raising your daughter?
Yeah, one of the things that when we went to pick a preschool, you know, I think we had to think of some things that other people might not have unless they're a same-sex couple. Because we had to think about, is her family going to be supported? You know, is she going to experience any kind of harassment or discrimination because she has a family that is queer? And so that was a statement or that we asked. You know, we asked and interviewed at the different preschools, you know, do you have other queer families and how are you with that? And we were able to find a preschool that was really wonderful and affirming. And so I feel fortunate about that.
You were at a children's museum a few weeks ago, I guess, that created a conversation. Was a springboard? Tell us about that.
Yeah. So these things happen a lot, actually. We were climbing on this structure, and this boy came up and said, hey, are you a girl or a boy? Now, my Duncan was sitting right here with me, and I said, well, I'm kind of both. And he said, well, you can't be both. You know, you have to be one or the other. And I said, well, I am kind of both. You know, I started out as a girl, but I grew up and became more like a boy. And so I am really sort of both. And, you know, Duncan had heard this before, so she was nonplussed. But I think the little boy was just, I could see him trying to wrap his brain around that.
Right, right. Well, and I guess it's good for her to hear that, to know that this is a conversation and this is her life.
Yeah.
Right? That's part of this. Yeah. It's interesting. You talk about this, the fact that there were these people, individuals in your life who were really important. But you notice, particularly when you dated an African-American woman, that there are also things that are structural and things about your life over which you have no control, and
right.
Perhaps no individual could have rescued you from. It's a real, I mean, it seems to me that those things were always at play in your life.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true.
And you have to sort of address all of that. I mean, I think sometimes the rugged individual, you know, philosophy is, well, look, you know, she did it. You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But there are other things that you can struggle against. If you had been sent to one of those detention centers instead of being let off, as you point out, you know, it's a whole different story.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd never gone to East Carolina University, if I'd never moved to Durham, I'd never met Meg, for example. And, you know, she helped me make peace with my past and helped me step into the future that is now. And that wouldn't have happened. And I think that there's also an element of grace, you know, getting a little spiritual here for a minute. You know, I think there's the institutions and there's the actions of the individual. There's the people in the life. You know, why did those people come into my life? I don't know. You know, why did things kind of work out the way they did for me? I don't know. You know, there's an element of grace about this, too, that I'm very mindful of and grateful for.
Congratulations. You've just won 2 awards. Tell us about those.
Yeah, I was granted the Pace Setter Award from UNC Greensboro, and that's an award that alumni get for reaching local, regional, or national acclaim. And then I was also inducted into the Order of the Golden Fleece at UNC Chapel Hill, which is an order of people who have left a lasting mark on the university.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Terry.
Oh,
what a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Been a pleasure.
Terry Phoenix, director of the LGBTQ Center at UNC Chapel Hill. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolf. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.